This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. If you've ever tried to figure out a doctor's handwriting on a prescription, you know it's a task on par with trying to solve a Rubik's Cube puzzle with one hand tied behind your back in a snowstorm. But all jokes about physician handwriting aside, verbal communication between a doctor or any healthcare provider and a patient can often range from confusing to non-existent. And our guests today say that is one of the biggest yet least talked about problems in our current healthcare system. If patients and healthcare providers aren't communicating effectively, a healthy outcome for the patient is at risk. Dr. Bernard Banman and Celia Banman are co-founders of the Center for Communication in Medicine. Dr. Bernard Banman is a clinical psychologist. Celia is an author who writes about these critical patient and healthcare provider issues. And they're joining us today from the studios of PEG TV in Rutland. And thank you so much both for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
And you can join the conversation as well. Do you feel frustrated by a lack of communication with your healthcare provider? What do you feel are the major barriers to understanding and getting all your questions answered? How can things be improved? If you do have a good level of communication with your healthcare provider, what makes it good? And do you think others could benefit from your example? The number to call to speak with our guest today is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a question or comment on our Vermont Edition Facebook page or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. Let me start with what seems like the most obvious problem when it comes to doctors or healthcare providers communicating well with patients, and that's that the subject matter really is inherently complex. I mean, medical terminology can seem like a totally foreign language to someone who hasn't spent years studying it, and that would be most of us. So how do you relate to a patient information about something that's inherently arcane, like a complicated disease or a diagnosis? And Dr. Banman, let's start with you on that one.
Well, it's very challenging for doctors and nurses, those who are caring for us, to speak in a language that we understand. It's so interesting. We hear so often the phrase, we have a right to know. But in our work, we really emphasize it's more about a right to understand. Because as you're saying, Mitch, there's so many complicated terms. And in addition, these conversations are emotionally charged. I don't know how often you and your listeners have been in the situation where you're sitting in the doctor's office and the doctor or nurse will come up and they'll say, you know, do you have any questions? And we will often sit there and be thinking, I don't know what questions to ask.
Mm. Yeah, that can be definitely part of the problem. And as you say, it is emotional. I mean, if you're waiting especially to hear about a diagnosis, you know, it can be days leading up to that where you've got so much worry and so much concern and it filters out to your family members. I mean, you're right. There's a lot of emotion involved in this. And Celia Banman, is there more of an onus on the doctor or healthcare provider to be the great communicator in this relationship? And if not, is that placing an unfair burden on the patient?
I think it's a shared responsibility. And I think in my work with patients, I help them find their own voice in being able to ask for what they need. And what I actually did when I met with each patient is I would document their understanding of their diagnosis, prognosis, treatment plan, and how they were coping with their illness. It was documented in the patient's chart, which was read by the doctor, and then doctors were prepared when they went in to, oftentimes they would say, well, they never told me that. But then they would go in prepared to ask specific questions. So it was a way of lending voice to both patient and doctor.
That's fascinating. So you're talking about almost like you're meeting with somebody and it's almost like a customized sort of meeting about their situation, about how they've been handling it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And oftentimes, you know, the language differences are really the barriers. And oftentimes they say, you hear what the doctor's saying, but you don't understand. Mm. And then, you know, I go home and I think about questions I wished I had asked. So when patients would tell me that, I would remind them that it's not too late to write it down so when they come in the next time with that question.
Dr. Bamman, I can imagine a doctor or nurse or any other healthcare provider hearing this and saying, hey, look, you don't have any idea how little time we have with each patient on a given day to talk about these things in the way you're saying we should. If we spend as much time talking with patients, you know, answering every question they had, we'd never get to any actual treatment. What do you say about the time crunch that is so prevalent in the American healthcare system?
Absolutely true. And in our work and in our Speak Sooner initiative, we recognize the pressures, the demands, the time issues that doctors and nurses increasingly are finding themselves in. And that's why we developed the Difficult Conversations Toolkit. And what this offers is for patients and their loved ones to be able to use the material, their prompts, based on what actual patients have experienced, to think about what their questions are and their concerns are. And what that really does, it helps them to be prepared to walk in the door. Again, the pressured situation at the office visit. They're walking the door prepared to ask the questions that matter to them. And in that way, it can be very time-saving, and you can avoid what often takes place is a mind reading between doctor and patient about what someone is interested or willing to hear.
We're talking about communication or a lack thereof when it comes to patients and their healthcare providers. We're speaking with Dr. Bernard Bamman and Celia Bamman, co-founders of the Centers for Communication in Medicine. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phones. We've got Scott on the line from Burlington. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to relate an experience that I just had with the passing of my mother in March of this year. She was out in California, and I flew out from Burlington to be with her when she was having some difficulties. And when I got to her house, I basically found that my mother was starving to death because she was taking so many meds in such an uncoordinated fashion, and it was impacting her appetite and her energy level. And I wanted to reiterate and really agree with your guests that the issues around compressed time, high pressure in these doctor's visits, the complexity of the issues involved, and then a patient who's not at the top of their game to interpret all that, sort out all the information they're getting, it makes it almost impossible to properly communicate with patients, especially if they do not bring in an advocate with them. The one thing that we found with my mom that was helpful is spent a day and a half going through all the meds that she'd got from all the doctors, from all the visits, from all the neighbors, put them in a spreadsheet, and figured out what the hell was going on with her. And we took that into the doctor's office, her primary care physician, and they commented how helpful that was to them in sorting it out, which begs the question, why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we using something as simple as a spreadsheet to communicate with patients, their advocates, and provide some kind of an organizational framework for something so complex and pressure-filled?
Scott, thank you very much for the call, and I'm sorry about that situation that happened with your mother. What do you have to say about what Scott is saying there, that it could be something as simple as a spreadsheet, but that may not be something that folks consider when they're talking about caring for a loved one?
It's really tough for the caregivers, you know, the family and friends in these kinds of situations, and they're impacted by the illness of their loved one. So they're also in an emotionally charged situation. But the caller really brought something up that is really key in this whole, you know, continuum of care, and that is the primary care doctor. We so often are in contact with specialists when you're dealing with serious illness. It's not just cancer. It could be heart disease. It could be neurological. I mean, a lot of things. The primary care doctor can serve the purpose of, in many ways, interpreting, reviewing with the patient and their loved ones. And so there's an extraordinarily valuable resource that sometimes gets lost in this process, and we need to bring to the attention of the patients and their loved ones that they should reach out, as this fellow did with his mom, to the primary care doctor.
Well, that is something that Rachel from Jamaica writes to talk about, too, because she mentions primary care doctors. She says, and she wrote this to us, I now tell everyone to switch doctors if they're not being listened to, not being taken seriously. If your gut says switch, do so as quickly as you can. A doctor who does not listen, a doctor who is just not good, can cause great suffering and can even kill you. Unfortunately, women are still thought to be anxious by some male doctors when they have odd complaints. Thank goodness, Rachel writes, for wonderful primary care doctors who listen and the highly skilled specialists who also listen. Celia, I do wonder about what Rachel is saying, though, when it comes to switching doctors. I mean, if you feel like my doctor is just not listening to me, maybe you are a woman and you have a male doctor and you feel you're not being taken seriously, should you switch?
I think ideally to be able to articulate to your doctor that they're not listening and identify what you need from your doctor and asking, are you able to work with me and help me and give me what I need? And that is, a patient then puts that out there to the doctor, and the doctor has to, you know, and some doctors do say, no, you know, this is, somebody told me the other day, doctor said, you're asking too much of me. I don't have the time.
Wow. I mean, if that happens, I mean, shouldn't then you say, listen, okay, I'm sorry you don't have the time, but I need the time. I need to find another doctor.
Exactly. But when you're in that moment, imagine yourself telling this to a doctor and the doctor looking at you and say, I have no time for you. So that piece of where do you go? I mean, that really ends the conversation right there because it's very personal, face to face. And this particular, you know, doctor didn't even apologize. You know, some doctors will say, you know, explain, I am sorry. This is, you know, I'm pulled in so many directions. And I have great compassion for doctors. They're faced with really the difficult task in many situations of reconciling patients to illness. And for some, you know, their impending death. So how do they prepare for that?
This brings up another question I have. I know that both of you have attended medical conferences and talked about these concerns. What kind of a reaction do you generally get from doctors and other healthcare providers when you say you have to communicate better with your patients?
Well, one of the answers we get is what we've already touched upon. We don't have time. And we had an experience, and I'll have Celia share it with you about that whole issue, because time seems to be a very common theme that comes up.
So we did a presentation and showed our video. And afterwards, I asked this was a group of oncology fellows, really a premier cancer institute. I said, what do you hear these patients saying to you? Dead silence. I said, okay. I asked again. The third time when I asked, one of the oncology fellows says, we have no time for these conversations. And I said, okay, I'm here because we created this workbook, and I'm going to wind it back to the patient who said, not everybody wants to have these conversations. Some people do. Doctors have a hard job. They have to know whether somebody's ready or not. So the notion that it's a shared responsibility, and it didn't move much, you know, more. It kept going till we don't have time.
Right.
And I reminded them, I live in Vermont. We have time in Vermont for these conversations. They are happening in Vermont.
Well, we certainly hope so. I'm sure that there are some doctors and healthcare providers that would more sympathize with the lack of time factor. But yeah, I think it's probably truer here than other places. We are talking about healthcare and communication with your health care provider today. You can give us a call. Let us know your story or your question at 1-800-639-2211 or post a question to our Vermont Edition Facebook page or send us an email, vermontedition@vpr.net. You know, it seems like there is the patient factor, too. Every patient is different. We're talking about different personalities that come into offices, and different people may have a different confidence level in talking to a physician or a healthcare provider. And I want to get back to something that I think our caller Scott was talking about. Is there a strong role to play for a spouse, a relative of the patient, to advocate for them and get questions answered if they know the patient is perhaps too timid to ask something or may not even know what to ask?
Well, one of the things that we recommend when the toolkit is introduced, and that can be whether it's in the medical practice or in our community programs, is that the patient and their family and the caregivers watch the video together and then go through the workbook together. And so in that way, they have an opportunity to discuss the issues. So when they come for their doctor's appointment, if the patient themselves is not comfortable, is anxious, whatever it may be, they do have an advocate with them who can ask the questions, express the concerns.
We've got Michael on the line from North Bennington. Hi, Michael.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call, and I've enjoyed this a lot. My father-in-law used to say, nobody gets out of this life alive. And I was just thinking before, we now strive to give our students and people courses in financial literacy in our schools. At what point do you think it is valuable and pertinent to give people this literacy, if you will, this fluency, ability to talk about life and death situations as a regular part of some curriculum that prepares them? I know when my brother was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer a number of years ago, we were gobsmacked, didn't know what to do, didn't know what to say. I've just found this conversation very refreshing, but I'd like to hear if there's some plan that might make this almost a course that people get in colleges and schools.
Thanks very much for that call, Michael.
I can tell you what my son, who lived with both of us growing up, often would say, it's not a life lesson, it's just a question. And he's come to know over the years there are many life lessons, and it becomes part. So I think it's a part of, in raising children, that we don't shy away from those conversations.
I'd like to add something else, if you don't mind, and that is in terms of what the caller is really talking about, I think it's much more about community-based education as opposed to the kind of education materials that would be introduced in a medical setting. And our Speak Through initiative is emphasizing community-based education. And I think it's a critical piece of getting the message out there in the public and offering workshops and programs to familiarize people with the Difficult Conversations Toolkit. And then they, in turn, can use it and bring it to their providers.
We're speaking with Dr. Bernard Badman and Celia Badman. They're the co-founders of the Centers for Communication in Medicine. We'll have more after this brief break. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and today we're talking about how to improve communication between patients and healthcare providers. Our guests today are Dr. Bernard Badman and Celia Badman, the co-founders of the Center for Communication in Medicine. If you've got a question, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211, post on our Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got this message from Joe in Middlebury, who writes, in their book Made to Stick, Chip and Dan Heath raised the issue of the curse of knowledge. That is, we often forget what it is that we didn't used to know and how difficult it might be for others to grasp those ideas. I have a sympathetic and well-trained general practitioner, Joe writes, but even so, she will on rare occasions make use of terminology that seems simple to her but doesn't compute for me, a layman. I suspect that one cause of miscommunication is that doctors don't want to insult the intelligence of their patients but forget how much of their knowledge is very specialized and fail to translate it into a common terminology. And that's something that we talked about at the top. Dr. Bandman, I wonder if there is a way or any kind of a movement to get doctors, and I know that they've already got enough to do and it's an extremely hard job, but to get them to be more conversant in translating their sometimes arcane medical terminology into layman's terms.
Well, I think what we're talking about brings us back to the role of the patient and their family, that we have to recognize that it's going to be up to us to say, you know, I don't understand what you're talking about. I know it's familiar to you. It's your language. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be very helpful if I do understand, because I want to be compliant. I want to be a good patient. So, you know, for physicians, for nurses, as we've talked about earlier, they're under tremendous pressure, and it's only going to increase. So that the responsibility really needs to shift, and that's not the way we usually think about things. You know, it's the doctor that, you know, they're going to tell us this and tell us that, and we kind of sit there passively. Not all of us, but some of us. We have to be the ones.
Let's go to Stephanie. She's on the line from South Burlington. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I think the doctors are pretty good, actually, all the time, and I've been through a lot. However, I came up to a few words in a poem. The doctor arrives harried. The appointment is hurried. The results are horrid.
Three H's.
And that's it.
Harried, hurried, and horrid.
Yeah, I think they're all doing a wonderful job, and it's a very tough thing with all the forms and computering, et cetera, which just takes away from the time they have with you.
Well, Stephanie, has your experience with doctors been such that when you have felt maybe harried and hurried, or they have felt that way, that you've been able to just pause the conversation and say, I'm sorry, doctor, I just want to go over this again, or I didn't understand that you said. Have you been able to communicate those thoughts?
I can't hear you. I'm sorry. It's fading.
I just wanted to know if you've had the experience where you've been able to communicate with your doctors when you do have an extra question and when you do want to understand something.
Yes, certainly.
And you found them receptive.
I mean, you try hard. I just feel sorry for them. I know there's a lot of burnout, and they are just, you know, under so much pressure.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the call, Stephanie. I do appreciate that. And we should remind folks, you know, we're not trying to dump on doctors here. Their job is extremely difficult, and it can't be very easy to communicate bad communication, rather bad information to someone when a diagnosis is bad. I mean, is that part of the problem, Celia, that you find too, that doctors who are human sometimes find it difficult to, you know, pass on tough information to a patient?
Absolutely. And it brings to mind one experience I had with one of the oncologists. And it was every Monday morning we had weekly meetings where we would go over new patients or patients whose disease has spread and different choices. And one of the doctors came in, and he was so excited that he had found this clinical trial for this patient. And he was sitting next to me, and I knew the patient. I knew his wife. And this was very difficult. And I put my hand on his. I said, "You took an oath to do no harm. You didn't take an oath to cure cancer."
Hmm.
And he welled up with tears and said, "Thank you." Later in the day, he came by and said, "We're not doing clinical trial. I didn't even approach it. Thank you."
Well, yeah, I think that's an important point. And another important point we're getting here from Natalia, who writes to us, "Huge piece missing from this conversation is the fact that insurance companies make it difficult for doctors to receive adequate reimbursement for more than 15 to 30 minutes of appointment time. Doctors are having to fight for pay with insurance companies. No wonder they're overloading their schedules, not able to talk to their patients. My husband is a primary care physician in Vermont, and this is the case in his practice. He is devastated by having to make the choice between taking care of his patients and his family. Really, this is a moot point without including insurance reform in the conversation." Dr. Bandman, what about insurance reform? Do insurers have to take a look at this too and say, hey, maybe we're part of the problem here?
Well, I think that's part of a larger movement. whereby we need to recognize, and as you could tell from our conversation, that we are very supportive and feel great compassion for the healthcare providers of these days. But to see it change with insurance reimbursements, being able to see that conversations, time for conversations, are reimbursed is really part of a larger movement. And the more we communicate about these issues, I think there's a greater chance that there may be a little bit of headway with that. But you know, this is taking on a major institution, the insurance industry.
Yeah, we could do another whole show on that topic, yeah. No question. Bonnie is on the line from Brookfield. Hello, Bonnie.
Hi. I was married to an internist who was known in our town to be the dear and beloved physician, and that's simply because he gave his patients time. When medicine became nonprofit, I mean profit, a profit organization in the 60s, this is what's come of it. And we don't have enough internists because they're not getting paid enough, and it's disastrous, just like small business. In any case, he used to say, the patient knows what's wrong when he comes in to the office. Your job is to settle them down, help them relax so you can get the symptoms you need. And he said, by the time they're walking out, you usually get the symptoms going out the door, which you need to make the diagnosis. In the meantime, they got to talk about Aunt Millie in Chicago. And I think that has to happen with all specialties. When I go to Dartmouth, for something, I immediately say to whoever it is I have to see, now take a deep breath and sit down and listen. Because I have my list of questions, and I intend for them to be responded to.
Bonnie,
and they do.
Yeah,
they stop, and they listen. But I think it's a two-way street here, and we've got to get in touch with each other again. That's all. Best wishes, everybody.
Thank you, Bonnie. I appreciate that call. I think that gets a little bit to what Natalia was saying, when you get into profit versus nonprofit situations, but also it sounds like Bonnie is someone who is willing to stay there until she gets her questions answered. And again, it's what you guys were talking about with the patient having to take some initiative here, too.
And that's the shared responsibility. And I think that's important.
Here's another thing I think that really might help, and I want to get both your thoughts on this. Sandy in North Ferrisburg suggests taping the conversation with your doctor. She finds it helpful to listen to later on, and she's never had a doctor refuse to do it. Are doctors open to that?
It's very interesting because that, in many ways, is the ideal, to be able to tape the conversation. And I know Celia would often say to the patient before they went in to see the doctor with the tape recorder, to remind the doctor the taping wasn't, for any litigious purpose. It was so that they would be able to take in all the information, because they would say to the doctor, I know I'm not going to remember most of what you have to say to me.
Mm-hmm.
And even if I have to write notes, I'm not going to get everything down. So having this tape recorder allows me to listen when I go home, and then I can formulate questions if I have them, which will only help in the care of me by you.
We have Mike on the line from Shelburne. Hi, Mike.
Hello there. Single most important thing to do, in my opinion, if you're facing a potentially critical conversation, and I say potentially because you don't always know whether it's going to be critical or not, I would take a friend with me. And I started doing that 15 years ago after making the mistake of having been prescribed an antibiotic that nearly killed me. Hmm. And I should have asked questions about alternatives, but I didn't. And I'm a quick learner. I don't do that anymore.
You're talking about a friend, literally not even a family member. You're saying take a friend with you to the doctor's office?
It could be a friend or a family member, somebody who's willing to listen, take notes, and ask questions.
And is that something that maybe this is a silly question on my part, Dr. Bernard, but is that allowed? In other
sure.
words, yeah, you can just take a friend with you?
It's up to the patient to decide who they would like with them in the visit, and it's someone they trust and someone they believe will be able to take in more information than they. You know, there's a part of the brain that shuts down when we hear emotionally frightening information. Yeah. So it's part of a natural response not to take it in. So having someone there, absolutely. And as the caller was saying, you know, going in prepared to us, it's the key piece to the work that we're doing. So that there's homework and that the questions are very specific. And yes, if you have someone there or you have a tape recorder, all the better.
And following up on that, the thing that I worry about sometimes is if you don't know the questions to ask, if you don't ask your doctor, are people turning more and more to the internet now as a stand-in? And I'm wondering then, you know, things like WebMD and folks go to those sites and they start typing things in and you know, they're not afraid there. They're not getting that personal interaction, but maybe they're getting information that isn't quite right.
Absolutely.
You just nailed it, that when people either avoid, they don't ask the questions, they feel they don't want to offend their doctor or they're just so uncomfortable, they do go to the internet. And we say, beware, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. So if someone is interested in gathering other information, I would suggest that they ask their doctor or nurse about what kind of sites that they should go to.
I want to ask you both as we sort of wrap up here, we're a little bit short on time, about sort of what you've found through your research on the general relationship between patients and their healthcare providers. Is it getting better? Is it adversarial? Because, you know, I worry about this becoming an adversarial relationship. It can't be. It's too important.
You know, it's more about frustration, and it's about facing the facts that we as patients are going to have to be more prepared and actively engage in decisions about care. And so, yes, ultimately, it's about developing a healthcare partnership. So it's not adversarial at all. It is not, absolutely not. But there's a lot of frustration, as we're describing today in the program, the pressures that are on doctors and nurses and all the healthcare providers, and what it's like for patients and their families to go in with a serious illness or a chronic condition and really need to understand what my options are.
And it was the reason that we created the workbook and video, that so if you don't know how to do it, it's sort of a guide. It's not the be-all, end-all, but it's a guide. You're listening to patients' voices, their experience. You're prompted with questions for yourselves. And oftentimes people have brought the toolkit with them and referred to it. So that helps. I mean, and then they can move away from it once they have built their, you know, the courage to do it and ask and not offend their doctor.
So we're going to have some information up on our website, the Vermont Edition page, about getting to those videos that you folks are talking about and ways to really improve this kind of communication over time. Finally, just the last word to you, Dr. Bernard. I'm sorry, Dr. Bannerman. If you have concerns about your healthcare provider, that you're not getting the kind of communication that you want to have, if it's been frustrating, what is the first question you should ask the next time you go in? But before you even get your next diagnosis, before you discuss the next step in your treatment, what should be the first thing you say to that provider?
Well, I believe you need to be able to recognize that and say, I realize that you're busy, you have a lot of demands on your time, but what I need to talk to you about is really critical for me. So I just need you to take the time today to answer my questions and really address my concerns.
Dr. Bernard Bannerman and Celia Bannerman, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much
for having us.
Thanks
so much for having us.
They're the co-founders of the Center for Communication in Medicine. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Vermont's new Attorney General, T.J. Donovan, was sworn into office last week. It was the first time in 10 election cycles that a new person was taking that oath, because that's how long Bill Sorrell held the office before deciding not to run for re-election. Sorrell sat down with Jane Lindholm yesterday to talk about his time in office and what's next.
This summer, as the election campaign was underway, then-Attorney General Bill Sorrell was our guest on Vermont Edition, and the topic of wind power came up, and he made this curious comment.
When I ride my bicycle in some parts of Vermont and I look up on ridgelines and see wind power there, there are any number of times when I regret that view.
Are you more free to say stuff like that since you're not running again this year?
Maybe, but wait till I'm no longer AG.
What are we going to hear from you then?
We'll see.
When a politician says that to you, you make a mental note to invite him back. Now no longer in public office, Bill Sorrell has taken a new position that puts him squarely at the intersection of environment and policy. And he's here to talk to us about all of that. And, well, I guess we'll see what else. Bill Sorrell, a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Oh, my pleasure, Jane.
Do you remember making that comment? What was in your head?
Well, I think that what was in my head was that what I was saying would surprise a lot of people. You know, in my business, whether it's in the campaign finance arena or nuclear power or wind power or civil rights issues, on and on, you know, there are those who think you're doing it just for political purpose to drive your own agenda and whatever. And I was just chose that opportunity to say, hey, I think renewable energy is hugely important, but I just I don't enjoy looking up at ridgelines and seeing industrial-size wind towers.
Were there other issues or cases that you had to represent the state in that went against your own personal beliefs?
Yes, there were some. But the state deserves to be well represented and then let the decision makers make their decisions. And there were times when I defended laws, or we defended laws, that had I been a legislator, I might not have been supportive of.
Like what?
I would have been maybe a little more careful in the campaign finance arena with the limitation on not only contributions to candidates but spending by candidates. I mean, we told the legislature that this was we would be the first state to do this, that this is a First Amendment arena of free speech, and that there was risk that if we were sued that we might not prevail, and then because it's a constitutional case, we would need to pay attorney's fees. I was happy to defend the law. From a policy stance, I thought it was a very good policy. But that's one that if I was in the legislature, I would have had to think long and hard before I voted for it, even though I agreed with it from a policy stance.
Yeah, that's kind of different in some ways, isn't it? Because that was one where your position as somebody who knows the law was to say, this is not necessarily going to fly. I will defend it as the attorney general, but I don't think this will stand up to scrutiny
under
the law.
I thought that there was real risk.
And it didn't.
Yeah. Now, another case where we defended the then Vermont law, and that was a situation where I absolutely was on the other side of the policy, was when our limitation of marriage to heterosexual couples was challenged. But what the legislature had done deserved to be defended. We defended it respectfully. Ultimately, the court ruled against gay marriage, but said that there's the entitlement to equal benefits and protections of marriage. And I was happy with that. And then I was very happy to put Vermont on the side elsewhere in the country in the federal courts on behalf of the right to marriage. So that was an example of a case where I was really on the other side of what we were trying to defend. And in one of the gubernatorial races one year, I was accused of, quote, having taken a dive in the case that – and what an insult that was to my assistant AGs, who were very smart, very principled people. And I didn't ask them, but I'd be shocked if they, from a policy stance, were not in favor of equal rights in this arena, but it was that was an insult to say that we just went through the motions of defending the law. That was just so bogus. But, you know.
So you never felt like you did your job any less forcefully if it was a policy you didn't agree with?
Never once. That wouldn't be fair to the office. It wouldn't be consistent with what I see the duties are. That was more fun when it was a law I really believed in, like the GMOs. I mean, I was so happy to be defending that. And
which is another case that some people said was unlikely to stand up to scrutiny.
Oh,
to
we told
scrutiny.
The legislature there was real risk, but we tried really hard to be of assistance to the legislature to craft a law that would be could be defended, and we were winning in court. Ultimately, the Second Circuit didn't need to rule because the Congress just turned around and preempted us. But we would not have a 50-state labeling requirement on the horizon but for what Vermont has done.
That's just one of the cases where what happens in Vermont may come into tension with what's going on at the federal level. And I'm curious what you think now as we enter a new administration.
I think my successor, T.J. Donovan, and other AGs, particularly who are elected Democrats, are going to have any number of real challenges.
Are there specific areas of policy where you think you see Vermont potentially having an issue?
Well, yes. I mean, we've tried in Vermont through the enactment of this policy that my office put together on bias-free policing and a policy that essentially advised Vermont law enforcement not to be inquiring about the immigration status of those, you know, farm workers in Vermont who interact with the police, whether stopped for a motor vehicle violation or even worse, when the victim of a crime and they're concerned about reporting it or what they're going to be asked, quite apart from what led to their victimization, if their immigration status is going to be questioned and they're going to be deported. Now, if the federal government turns around and really ups the ante on requiring state and local officials to make these inquiries, to actually challenge this sanctuary city or sanctuary state policies, there could be significant litigation going forward with states against states and obviously the U.S. Department of Justice espousing a position that's consistent with that of the majority of the Congress and the then president.
I'm talking with now former Attorney General Bill Sorrell, looking back at his time in office and looking forward as well to some of the challenges that he sees facing the state of Vermont. What would you point to as your greatest successes or most proud achievements in your time in office?
Well, I'm most proud of the fact that, you know, from my parents, that you have an obligation to try to leave the world better than you found it, and the amount you owe is dependent on the gifts and opportunities you're given. And so I feel so very fortunate that I was able for just under 20 years to hold this hugely important office.
So you don't look at certain issues like GMOs or dealing with environmental regulations and smog emissions
Well, tobacco, that was me. I mean, it remains the greatest avoidable public health problem that we face today. You know, and then there are cases large and small. I mean, you talk about being proud, we successfully defended the so-called California standard of emissions from automobiles in federal court right here in Burlington. Talk about the health of the environment, greenhouse gas emissions and everything. Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of things to be immensely proud of. And sometimes it wasn't a huge case, but just you know you profoundly affected in a positive way someone's – the quality of someone's life. I mean, we – I went to the legislature and knew how much online downloading and sharing of child pornography there was that was not being investigated, and said, you give me the resources, we'll do these cases. And we – have been executing search warrants more than one a month all over the state, and successfully prosecuting ourselves or turning over cases to the federal authorities to prosecute. But in a number of those cases here in Vermont, it wasn't just possession and sharing of child pornography. But when we got in there, looked at the digital evidence after getting the search warrants, we found that there was a child or children in that home who were being sexually abused and filmed and were the victims in child pornography. And just thinking it's terrible what has happened to that child or those children, but from our action, there was at least a stopping point. And I'm immensely proud of that. Overall, I'm just proud that I always kept in mind that I was should be doing the right thing. And I think it's so important for the integrity of our systems of law enforcement that you really try to be even-handed, and that there's nothing worse than when the government overreaches and uses the power it has to harm people. I've so frequently said, underutilize your power. Always be in awe of the responsibility that you have when you go about your work.
As you say those things, I imagine that somewhere in your head is also this question that was raised about you and your integrity. Was the work of your office too close to some of the people who gave you money in political fundraising? You know, were you essentially doing pay for play for so people who gave you large donations? I mean, these were allegations.
Sure, there were allegations, and they were investigated by outside neutral entity. The ethics board looked at whether I did anything unethical. State and federal law enforcement looked whether I took bribes, and it was all cleared on all of it.
Do you worry or care that it may have tarnished your legacy? Do you think it
I don't
may?
Think it tarnished my legacy at all, quite frankly. I was never worried that when there was a full and fair investigation, as opposed to just a political hatchet man making these allegations, I was not worried that the facts or the law would show that I had done anything but was of a very high caliber of integrity in going about my work. Do I wish it hadn't happened? Sure. Wasn't fun, but you make enemies in this business when you enforce the laws, and when you enforce them against some powerful parties, there's going to be blowback. And good question as to who funded all of those allegations. That's a great question. Somebody ought to find that out.
Are you angry?
Sure.
Because why?
Because I thought it was unfair, and I thought it was partisan, political, you know, D.C. type gutter politics.
And we're talking about Brady Tensing here.
We are.
So no love lost, safe to say. I mean, I can tell your demeanor has changed, your facial expression, and it just seems like this is still something that feels very personal to you, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, very personal. No question about that. I know that I always tried to do what's right. I'm proud of what I've done.
Your new job is as a visiting scholar with Vermont Law School. What are you going to be doing?
I'm going to be lecturing and as been named an honorary visiting scholar by their Asian Program in Environmental Studies for 2017. And in mid to late February, I'll be heading to China and spending 6 weeks or so there, and I'll be lecturing at a number of law schools and giving some other lectures in five different cities around the country. little intimidating to me, I have to say. But I got advice from some former AGs about don't make long-term decisions about what you're going to do after you cycle out as AG. Do something different for 3 or 4 months. And here I am off to China. And I think it's going to be a great adventure. And I'm so looking forward to it.
Bill Sorrell, good luck to you, and thanks for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
Bill Sorrell served as Vermont's Attorney General from 1997 until last week, just shy of 20 years. This interview is just an excerpt of the half-hour conversation that Jane had with Sorrell. The full interview will be available later today at vpr.net. Tomorrow, we're going to learn about a very mysterious fish. Lake sturgeon are on the state's endangered list, but surprisingly, we don't know how many are actually swimming in Lake Champlain. We'll discuss the characteristics of this prehistoric being and what efforts are underway to count them and protect them. Email your sturgeon questions or comments to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Thanks for listening.